It's good to see everybody. Seeing dangerous much. Good to be back in a healthy state. We're going to start off with public comments, and then we have a presentation from some community members. So, Ryan, do we have public comment cards tonight?
Yeah, there's some out there.
I have two comments.
All right, Miss Jerry Penn. There you are. Hello, Jerry.
Do I have to go here?
If you can.
Okay. My name's Jerry Penn, and I've been dealing with code enforcement for about 12 years, and I know you're going to be working on the sign ordinance. So I made a copy of CDs for each of you of some samples of banner and sign violations over the past couple of years. I really hope that you will not make the sign code less restrictive, because as some of you already know, it can just go crazy, and the visual pollution and what it does to the community as far as how a community looks is awful. The current codes are applicable not only to residents and businesses, but as well to nonprofit organizations. They're held to the same codes as everyone else. And I hope that in going over these sign ordinances, you keep them pretty strict. Also, Sandy Springs and Doraville, for any of their signs, all banners must be permitted. And they have a sticker system so that if a code enforcement officer is called out to check on a banner, they automatically know whether it's been permitted or not. All the ones that I have reported in the past couple of years have been non-permitted banners. And banners are allowed for special events currently, twice a year, 18 days at a time, outside of the overlay district. So here are your CDs, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks, Jerry.
You're welcome. And can you give one to
you? 14 days, three times.
I guess that was an inside or private joke. Danny, would you like to share? No, I won't put you on the spot. All right, thank you.
Not too late for that.
John, would you like to lead us in pledge of allegiance?
Absolutely. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, John. Late entry.
She said I missed her.
All right. Ms. Harris.
I'm not even quite sure what to call it. The info ordinance that you guys have probably seen from females flying back and forth on. There was just one inadvertent addition in one of the versions that needs to be taken out. In your zoning code, chapter 27, is on page 261, or in the November 17th version of the info ordinance, it is on page 5, and it deals with the retaining wall, where we just need to delete the side in front of the property line, so that the retaining wall we get. Newly constructed retaining walls in single-family residential districts shall not be higher than 4 feet. The distance between the retaining wall and the property line instead of side property line. And I guess if you can picture a corner lot where somebody's backyard is somebody else's side property line, you don't want the corner lot backyard to be able to butt up exactly to the property line. And that was just to cover that off. So in one of the versions that got put in, it was supposed to be taken out. Bob Lunson will back me up on that. And when I was talking to Commissioner Boyer today, she was like, oh, yeah, have him give me a call. It was just one of those that got overlooked and it should be deleted. So page 261, section 454. And then if you want to go smaller, it's on page 5 of the November 17th thing. where is it? Section 2792, no, that's not right. Section 2787, Part B. That's all.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Ayers. All right, we now have a presentation of appreciation for the community. This is what this is titled. I'm not sure if it's the best title, but I believe Ms. Wingate.
With your permission, Mayor, I'd like to stand on this side of the room since the community is involved in this presentation.
Absolutely.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, City Council members, and friends of the community. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. About a month ago, Bill Robinson and I approached the mayor, and we volunteered to get some items that we knew the city council would need. So tonight, we are here to announce mission accomplished. And what an easy mission it was, because the first three organizations that learned of our quest immediately volunteered the money that was necessary to buy the gifts that we present tonight. That was most gratifying. But I will also tell you it was not so surprising because they are three of the organizations in Dunwoody whose volunteer members have brought our community to where the city of Dunwoody is today. So we are accustomed to their kindness and their many hours of work. Because we knew this was going to be a long work session tonight, we wanted to keep the presentation short, and our presenters agreed not to speak for their organizations tonight, but I will attempt in a few words to sum up what they're going to do. Bill Robinson was kind enough to take pictures. Everyone arrived early enough. We took the photo op session ahead of this meeting so we wouldn't delay the meeting. Mr. Mayor, if you would come over now for the benefit of the community, I'd like to once again officially present these items to you. Let me get a little bit over here out of the way. And let's begin with Citizens for Dunwoody. Tonight, representing was Don Converse, board member.
Citizens for Dunwoody, we'd like to present you to the council with the American flag at George Clark.
Very nice.
Mayor and members of the audience, I do have to point out just one thing. If you think that these flags might look smaller than the flag over there, I just want you to know we did not cut costs and skimp and buy a smaller flag. We had a nice flag that was 8 foot tall, but it didn't fit in the temporary quarters at City Hall. Those ceilings are somewhat smaller than or shorter than the average governmental building. So we have now gone back to get a 7 foot pole, which now enables us to top out about a little under 9 feet, and then we do fit into City Hall at the present time. Secondly, Dunwoody Homeowners Association. A man that needs no introduction, of course.
President
of the DHA.
Well, since we have a rather no-name bunch that got elected to the city council, DHA is proud to present to the mayor and to the city council each a nameplate to sit up there so when citizens actually address you, you're no longer anonymous.
Thank you.
Now we have Dunwoody Woman's Club. This is a public affairs chairman, Jean Kemper, and she has two different items that she would like to present. We're giving you the gavel to keep order and a sounding block with the logo and name badges for all of the members so that when they're out and about, we'll know who they are. Looking around, and inasmuch as I do not see our legislators here tonight, I can safely say, because I know you will never tell Fran Miller or Dan Weber I said this, but I happen to think that the very attractive brass and black looks much better than that blue and white that the state legislature has. I think we'll be proud of our council. Here's our presentation. Each one of our groups wanted us to send you, council members their best wishes and good luck into the future as you move forward. They're grateful for your stepping forward to do this. And of course, I bring our own personal greetings from the DHA, Dunwoody Women's Club, Citizens for Dunwoody, Bill Robinson, and myself. Thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much.
I wonder if it just barely fit.
Can I see your glasses?
Just for the record.
Yours is 2 inches longer.
$1,000 in value. And I'd like to know about how long it took to sew those flags.
Maybe something you can tell us in some other time. Thank you very much, guys. This does mean a lot. And I know to all of us, speaking on behalf of the council and myself. And I'll use this in appropriate measure and time. And I can retire, I guess, the official compliments of the Georgia correctional industry. This is forever retired. Thank you. Yeah, I'll give it to the chief. You're right. Okay. Move on to business here. I do have a couple of quick announcements before we go down the particular items. One would be, I would just ask council, and I haven't spoken to any of you about this, but as we move down these items, a couple things I'd like to spin off a couple committees. And I'm suggesting that we have a finance committee, and I'm suggesting that Councilman Wittenstein chair this committee as we're moving into the budget to help us organize on that financial side. And the other suggestion I'm going to make is that we do have a formal legislative committee, and I'm going to ask Councilman Taylor to chair that. And with the Gold Dome opening up their doors here shortly, we're going to have a number of items that we're going to want to discuss and with our legislators. So I'd ask Tom if you guys will. Is that acceptable?
Absolutely.
You guys, okay, great. Want to get that out of the way. And another item, again, just a general topic, and we won't discuss it tonight, but I understand from our city attorney that there's been 9 applications filed with DeKalb County for 9 new billboards to be erected in Dunwoody. And these billboards are located everywhere from Dunwoody Village to Orchard Park to all over the place. So our council is working diligently. We will have more information as we move along, but I want to give everybody word on that. New development as of 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
Do we know what the date of those applications were, and do we know whether DeKalb County has approved those applications or not?
Mr. Anderson?
They were given today. They have not been approved, I hope.
Okay. So we are going to begin discussing proposed Chapter 7. I think we have Lenny.
Yes, I don't have to read those.
Okay, today. Yeah, you don't have to read that. All right, does anybody have any... I'm a little cold here. They're having the flu for the week. I got to get back in the procedural piece of this on a work session. Does anybody have any discussion on Chapter 7?
Mr. Mayor.
Yes, Robert.
There were two things that I wanted to at least bring up for us to at least talk about.
Yes.
The first is that I note that in the building code section, the requirement to bring a building up to current code is that the renovations exceed 50% of the cost of the building.
Right.
And that is strikes me as being a really high watermark. And what I think that means is that you'll almost never, ever see a situation where a building that's out of code has to be brought into code short of demolishment. And I wonder if we don't want to think about lowering that some, because really, I don't know that it serves anybody's interest to keep buildings around that aren't up to current code. And 50% just seemed like way too high. I was thinking more like 25 or 30. But I'd love to hear everybody else's thoughts.
Okay, you know, I noticed that was actually a red line, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In the document. Brian, can you address that for the board?
We've got our community development. Actually, we got one.
We got two of them.
Introduce yourself for some moment.
Sure. Jeff Timler with the Community Development Department, and be happy to answer any questions. I believe it does say 50% in the code, and historically speaking, in most jurisdictions, it is a requirement. Going lower, of course, I don't see a whole lot of potential for problems. You could have a possibility of, for example, a church that, of course, has a fire or something like that, and that would cause them to bring up major renovations, major costs. That's only one potential I could see. But bring it down to maybe 30% or 40% may be feasible. The amount that we look at, of course, is the amount the tax assessor assesses the property and the structure at. So it's pretty fair market. And then, of course, the building permit that's submitted would also indicate the amount of the construction costs.
Okay. While we have Jeff up to the stand, questions, he has things. Can you tell us some of the positive aspects that you made at that level, Jeff?
Well, it would obviously, I think, benefit the property owner that went through a major catastrophe, or 50% of the catastrophe, I think that would help the property owner. You know, there's a lot of older buildings, I think, that you may have going forward that you know, whether it's piping or plumbing or HVAC or, you know, fire marshal requirements, those do change drastically. And I just think it from a financial burden, from some people, it may cause a problem. But on a positive note, obviously you make it a safer building, that's, you know, safer access, and it's just definitely a financial concern for most.
I guess my question is, you know, there are some apartment buildings that are questionable here in the city. And that's one of my questions, that the safety aspect of the citizens that are living in these apartment buildings.
Bringing those up to code, you know, that may be a trigger point, obviously, where, I mean, if you made it a lower percentage or higher percentage, it could trigger the total demolition of that building, because after you go in and modify so much, it's not cost effective to keep the building, so you just end up tearing it down.
In that aspect, it could be a positive thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
I got one more.
Robert, yes.
So just the only other thing that I had in the code section was that I note that there is no minimum on the size of a project that requires a permit. So if, according to the way I read it, if I want to put in a new countertop in my kitchen, I have to have a permit. There was an earlier draft at which we had a $5,000, any home improvement project that cost less than $5,000 didn't require you to get a permit. That's been struck from the most recent versions. And while $5,000 seems maybe too high, zero seems maybe too low. And I'm just curious whether it really makes sense to require every home improvement to need a permit.
I believe that applies to most trades, like electrical, plumbing, HVAC. It doesn't apply to something minor in that nature. Our building inspector, actually, who hasn't even started working for us yet, he's actually commented on this. It was a practical workforce without being paid. He did a great job and found that, in my opinion, because, for example, if you get a water heater put in, which, you know, that's going to be a major issue if you don't install it correctly, or HVAC, that's under $5,000. Those are major issues that if it's not put in correctly, the permit is not inspected correctly, you could have a major problem.
So, I mean, the water heater is a perfect example. So if you call a licensed plumber and he wants to replace your water heater, he's got to come to the city and get a permit before he can replace it?
Yes, sir.
I think we need to take a look at that.
Yeah, that's...
Because that comes under emergency circumstances. You know, I mean, you could have a water heater bucket and...
Some jurisdictions require it, some don't. It's just,
I mean, I can see that you don't want anything major, but you know, again, small stuff, you ought to be able to go to Home Depot, or you ought to be able to use a contractor and do something minor to your house and not have to worry that you're in violation because you didn't. And you guys don't want to be inundated with these little petty anythings when you've got a lot of stuff to do. All right.
Are there any other things I've got in here that we may not have?
We tried to redline them so you would know what we were changing from the cabs. And so hopefully you're aware of those changes throughout the document. That was the only one that I can think of that the building inspector thought that should be changed.
Okay, anything else for, but I think we do need to come up with some amount, some wording that protects the one that in the middle of the night is not becoming goes there, so that's something I think we will have to come up with, Jeff. Maybe a dollar amount also, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000, whatever it is. So you can get your hot water heater fixed, thank you, now it's up there. Anything else, Jeff? Yes, Warren?
One additional staff comment. This is Jennifer Peterson. She's going to be our ongoing community development director. So one, I wanted to introduce her, but also we just faced an extremely similar question almost yearly in Norcross, and Jennifer's been dealing with that. So I just wanted her to give you a little bit further information.
Fantastic.
Sorry, you get two for the price of one of the directors tonight, so you're going to see both of us talking. Within the international code, in each different section, residential code, building code, mechanical code, there is a specific page that is called exemptions, and it goes into infinite detail of what does require a permit and what does not require a permit. Oftentimes, that is not based upon the value of the dollar of what you're doing, but more of the scope of work. If you would like a copy of that, I'd be happy to make copies, highlight some sections, and send it over if that's something you're not familiar with.
I'd feel better if I knew what you needed a permit for and what you didn't. Right?
Exactly.
That's really what
this is going to. This is a classic challenge for any department in that the detail level of what needs a permit and doesn't need a permit. It's a constant education with the public. And what I tell people all the time is, if you've got an emergency in your house, deal with it. Don't worry about the permit. We'll talk with you when you're ready.
Does that list change a lot every year?
The ICC, the International Code Council, does do revisions to the code, on the most part, for an annual basis. That list doesn't significantly change, but there are small fine-tunings to it.
What about putting the list in here so that the ordinance actually says these are the things that you don't need a permit for in a residence?
We can do that. It's a couple of pages worth of list, and for the sake of...
We don't seem to be shy about that.
I know, I started this morning, and I started to do that contract. I completely understand. My one concern would be when you have codes and duplicate sections, as one book changes, you have the opportunity to maybe not revise this book, so you can get out of date. So I'm a big fan of keeping the regulation in one place, so you're always up to date. But if that's what you wish to do, we can certainly do that.
An appendix, maybe? And just refer to the appendix?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Could we incorporate by reference?
Yes.
It is incorporated by reference.
Yes. Okay.
That keeps us up to
exactly.
Whatever updates occur.
Something like the air conditioning or a heating system, I mean, those are common things that go out and they could cost as much as $2,500 to $3,000. Okay. Is that excluded?
Again, it kind of depends upon the scope. The best example I have was a situation I recently went through with the replacement of a water line. If you've got a leak somewhere in the line from the street to your home, once it's on your property, it's your responsibility. If you were replacing a section of line less than 10 feet, then you don't need a permit unless it's at such and such angle, and then you have to have a coupling. And so it gets into a level of detail that I can't quote to you each circumstance that would happen.
And under those conditions... Under those conditions, Jennifer, that would be considered an emergency situation. Mm-hmm. Is that something, somehow we could put that into somebody that can kind of smooth the emergency and put it in there that everyone would know that the emergency situation is, regardless of not get it fixed, and then we'll handle a permit later? Because if your water line's broken, I bet you a lot of us right here had that. Because we've got famous pipes around here.
Absolutely.
So I don't know, but somehow or another, we can just kind of protect things that can be done that need to be on an emergency basis. I don't know, maybe we can even list them, like water, heat, basic electricity, the basic necessities. I'm just throwing this out.
Anybody else have anything? Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer. Well, moving forward. All right, you guys have any other discussion items on Chapter 7 before we move ahead? All right, moving to chapter 14.
I have things on all of these, so you just might as well. And I'm going to try not to waste people's time or belabor them, but I earmarked my copy pretty consistently. Yeah. So, just a few things to note. Again, there's a requirement for 50% of the market value before you trip the change, and I thought that was high. I noted in several places. And here's my environmental hat coming on, that the code allows the appeals board to grant variances for land disturbance up to within 25 feet of a stream bed. Now, that's about the width of my dining room. And that seemed way too close to me. Now, it doesn't require that they grant variances. It's 75 feet is the, you know, was the normal thing, and it allowed you to grant variances for land disturbance up to 25. That just seemed really close to me, and I'd love to see, again, in some level, it depends on who we appoint to the appeals board, right? And if we got good people on the appeals board, they'll use common sense, and it won't be a problem, but it does worry me that that seems pretty small to me.
Can I stop you there? And that, Brian, do you happen to know is that a federal 25 feet?
State. The state's the 25 feet is the state minimum. So you can't encroach any closer than that because we don't have the right to do that. But
got it. What is DeKalb County now?
Plus 75 is what you can do. The stream buffer variance is 75 feet from the center line of the stream.
Can you get closer?
Or the appeals can grant a variance within that 50 feet. Nobody can wait by the 25.
So this is the same ordinance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Kev is redoing theirs now.
Okay. Do you know what?
I'll get you a copy of the form.
John?
Go ahead. No. If it's on this, this is also our tree protection ordinance. And I wanted to make sure, how close does this mirror DeKalb County's tree protection ordinance? Is it very close?
So I'll tell you what we did. We started with DeKalb County, then we gave it to our staff, and then they massaged it tremendously, so Jeff could probably answer it more.
It actually totally takes it out and replaces it with a much better, more comprehensive ordinance. The ordinance that we're looking at is one that was used in a city that was Tree City USA for 5 years.
Tree City USA is the website that I saw. Okay. Arborists, yes. Great. Go ahead.
And it actually has a tree bank requirement. For example, should a developer not have enough land to replace all the trees, he basically goes in and does a survey of all the existing canopy. Some plots we have a tremendous amount of trees, obviously, so you don't have a whole lot there. But in the event that you have a lot of trees, each one of those trees are calculated, and if he can't place them on his proposed property, he'll give the city funds for those replacement values. And then the city is able to take those funds and plant trees in public right-of-way or on public property.
Right. Will the city be having an arborist on site? Will we have an arborist to do these evaluations?
Yes, the city will be. I have a designee that will be the city arborist, yes, sir.
Okay, and since you brought up the Trees USA, the only requirement then, one of the requirements we're missing is a tree board or a community group that would be looking and evaluating projects based on that. Was that any part or ideas or thoughts since you followed the other aspects of Tree USA?
The ordinance does not require a tree board.
Right.
I don't recall the Tree USA application actually requiring it to have a board. Is that one of the points of that?
It's part of the designation of tree board.
And
does the community ordinance form that tree board separately?
All right, so we can form that tree board and then just do the one last thing, which is Arbor Day observance and forestry program. And after that, we can be Tree USA certified as far as I'm concerned. Okay, thank you.
How about when an owner cuts down a tree?
residential.
What does the ordinance provide for there?
It allows you to do that. Yeah. It does not get into residential single lot owners. Now, if this developer comes in for you know, a massive residential development, then he's got to take massive trees. Yes.
What about a tear down and reconstruction?
I believe it does not apply to that. I believe it's just for new development purposes.
Mr. Mayor?
Yeah.
I have noted that there was no process for permitting anybody to take down as many trees as they wanted on their lot. So if you own the lot and you're a residential owner, you can take down. And I think that was one of the things that the cab ordinance kept you from doing. I think if it was more than five trees, you had to have a permit. And I sort of liked that because I'm a tree hugger, right? The other thing that I noted in this ordinance was that it only protects trees in what it kept referring to as the protected zone of the lot. So the sense that I came away with was that these trees over here you can't touch, but these other trees on the lot you can do whatever you want with. And I wondered whether that was wise or not.
Well, in the site development phases, determining where your building's going to be and where your parking lot's going to be, we hope there's enough land to protect a certain species you want to protect, like a large oak tree, for example, versus the pine trees you're going to probably take down because they're not considered a quality tree to a lot of arborists. And so that references that protected zone. Typically, you'll have a construction fence around it, so the heavy machinery can't get into the root system. Because when the heavy machinery gets into the root system, it obviously damages the tree's life expectancy. And so that's what this referring to is actual protected zone that's established during that plan review process.
So, if I understand the process correctly, the developer presents to you a plan where he's decided where the protected zones are, right? With the understanding that he gets to do any earth moving he wants on anything else, and you guys review that, and if you think he's gone overboard with the size of the lot he wants to disturb, you can ask him to make sure, you can insist that he make changes for approval, right?
Right.
But more or less, he gets to decide how much space his bulldozers need and how much the vegetation ought to be protected.
If he's made the proper calculations in terms of what's going to be replaced, and he can totally replace them on-site, then the tree bank basically says you have to make an effort to replant as many trees as you can. In the event that you cannot, then you will donate. So, you know, staff will make sure that he can protect as much as he can, but at the end of the day, it is his, you know, he's trying to make the most improvements on his land as possible, I'm sure.
Thanks. Usually protecting the trees means protecting under the canopy, is that right, Jim?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Usually it's the furthest out the limbs are go is basically the area that you want to take the roots. Yeah, right. It's usually, I mean, a large oak tree that could be, you know, 50 feet or so or more.
You know, we need to preserve as many trees as we can, and we need to preserve our green space. We also got to remember we have, you know, the rights of the property owner. We'll get, you know, if you got, any of you have got some nice sweet gum trees, you've had an enjoyment of picking up the little birds to your ruined face, and I consider that public enemy number one. I think, you know, there's aspects of that, and I think the idea of a quality tree versus an unquality tree is very important here as we get into this. But I agree, we don't want to strip the land around here.
Okay. Any other questions regarding the tree?
All right, Robert. I'm done with trees, but I do have a couple of others on this ordinance. I noted that on page 56, we require a performance bond of 115% for the cost of landscaping for 1 to 2 years. And that struck me as really excessive. Bob Lunson shaking his head no, that it's not excessive. But
the trees, you know, whether they're new or they're existing, based upon the impact that they're not supposed to be given to the canopy area, you know, the tree could die in a year or 2 years, especially the new trees, and that's why that's in place. So in 2 years, the staff will go out there and say, well, based upon the site plan, these trees are still here or these trees are dead. If they're dead, then they make the owner replant the trees.
Okay. All right. I guess I don't mind that. And I had only one other issue on this particular ordinance, and that was that it requires 5-foot sidewalks. And I think mostly what we have in Dunwoody is 4-foot sidewalks. And again, if I'm going to have a foot, I'd rather it be grass than concrete. And I know that wide sidewalks can be nice in some places, but this is a blanket requirement that all sidewalks be 5 feet wide. And I'm not sure we want to legislate that.
That may not be consistent with what the code already calls out in there. I'll have to check on that. I know the state's, I'll state resident is 5 feet.
Ben.
Can we ask Richard?
Richard being, I'm the public works director. 5 feet is one of the ADA requirements for sidewalks.
Okay.
So then that's the standard width for ADA.
Then it's 5 feet. That's it for me for this one.
Okay, that's it.
Oh, wait, John's got
it. Well, regarding sidewalks, part of our comprehensive land use plan will have a transportation aspect where the sidewalk widths will be discussed. We may be even be doing a land use plan as far as looking at the PCID, what they do in the business districts, and looking at it again at that time.
Right.
So, I mean, it's another time to explore it. It's coming up soon.
Absolutely. And encourage, too, to take a look at the, again, I brought this up before, but the new bank, if you look at the overlay's got different standards, as we know, but on sidewalks, but that's a, somewhere around there, because you see their bicycle racks, their fences, there's poles to protect walkers, you can walk next to each other, so there's aspects. And then PCID just did, over where the Delta ticket office used to be, a pretty wide thoroughfare, so it's, interesting aspect if you actually get out there and walk.
The flip side of that is it does inhibit the number of linear feet of sidewalk you can put in because the cost of each linear foot goes up.
You're right.
So there's a trade-off there. But again, if it's an ADA requirement, then that's what you do. So that's it.
Yes, Dennis.
Okay, question for Richard again. On your bid, does it bid linear foot on a 5 foot wide sidewalk?
Yes. Yeah. 5 foot, we assume 5 foot wide.
All right, any other chapter 14? If not, we're going to move on to chapter 16. Robert, I will start with you.
All right. This is the most important comment I have of the night. Because I actually found that there's one of these sentences that I periodically violate. And I just assume not.
We know it's in that chapter.
I'll digress for just a second. My libertarian tendencies came out a little bit as I read this ordinance. The number of ways and things that we've made illegal just boggles my mind. It seems in many places really intrusive. But the only thing that I think I'm guilty of breaking on a periodic basis is Article 1, Section 3B, page 3, and it talks about no drinking of alcoholic beverages in parks. And I have been to the Nature Center and had a picnic with a bottle of wine, and in fact, I'm pretty sure I've seen at least half of the rest of my fellow councilmen up there, either enjoying a beer or a bottle of wine at an event up at the park. And it strikes me that there are so many other ways that you can get somebody for public drunkenness or disorderly conduct or driving under the influence, that perhaps since this is something that I wouldn't go so far as to say that some of these places encourage, if they're going to have an evening concert and invite you to bring a picnic, that perhaps that's a sentence that we can take out and unless we discover we've got a problem, and then perhaps we can put it in. So my recommendation is that in Article 1, Section 3B, page 3, we take out that one sentence. I did also note that there is a requirement in here, which I don't think is in DeKalb County Code, to register burglar alarms for commercial businesses.
Right.
And again, I don't know that I mind, but if we don't want to add extra burdens to our businesses, again, I'd be interested in what the police have to say about whether it's really useful or not, but I didn't note that they had
it. I'll be happy to address that. I actually was going to comment on this. I just had a chance to review it today, and one of the things I noted was the alarm ordinance. And I actually don't think that one's a very good one. In my opinion, it leaves out a number of things, such as an appeals process if somebody gets assessed a fine, and some things like that. The Georgia Association of Chiefs of Police and the GMA have a recommended model ordinance for false alarms, which is one that we've adopted in Marietta. And the biggest thing about alarms is it consumes a lot of man hours from your police department, so you're responding to a lot of calls for service that are really unnecessary. And usually you send two officers to these type of calls. And haven't really got the data yet, but some data that you sent me from 2005, I think, mm-hmm. there were like 5,000 false alarms.
In Dunwoody.
In Dunwoody. So if that is increased in the last few years, then that's a considerable amount of manpower that's spent responding to really unnecessary calls. And we can better use our time, obviously, responding to other things or being proactive in our approach. In Marietta, so far this year, we started in January, and we've had about an 18 to 20% reduction in false alarm calls by enacting an ordinance there. And I don't think this one is a thorough enough one, and I would prefer at a later point to submit maybe one that would be that we can massage for Dunwoody.
Great. I'll take the liberty to ask Mr. Grossman for some opinion. If I remember correctly, you put together a white paper. Where did you gather your information?
Well, some of it was from the International Police Chiefs Association has a model ordinance, and I looked at that, and I also looked at trying to find the most draconian ordinance I could find. That was probably Los Angeles. But in retrospect, after getting into it, I feel it's appropriate for you to put together an alarm advisory committee that has all the stakeholders represented, including representatives from the alarm industry, the police department, and the community. And they would fine-tune the ordinance and then bring it back to you.
Okay. Is there anything on your white paper that you think would be useful for a chief?
Possibly. I broached the subject with him when we first met, that I was interested in the subject, but I haven't sent him what little I came up with.
All right, why don't you email me that again, and I'll get it to the chief. I'll get your hands and see if it helps.
Mr. Mayor.
Yes.
Once the Dunwoody Police Department is up and running, you know, I would think that this ordinance would not become effective till January of 2010,
right.
Or not 2010, January 2010, because it'll take some time for people to register, and we have to get certain software to be able to do all this without manually having to do it. So, yeah, we've got a little
time on our side.
Yes,
okay. So we should take this out,
correct?
Because this requires everybody to register. Yes. Within 9 months of the city, of us passing this ordinance.
Yeah. Right.
So that section should probably come out there.
Yes, any other information?
Yeah. Chapter, Robert, you talking about?
Oh, I'm talking about Article 2, Section 3, which is page 12.
Anything else on Chapter 16?
I got one more.
Okay,
this is my last one. This may not be the time, but I would love for us to debate and consider banning indoor smoking and extending that ban to include bars. The ban that we've got in here includes restaurants, but not bars. If it's bad for bystanders, it's bad for bystanders. And if it's bad for employees, it's bad for the employees. And I'd love to, as much as I feel a libertarian, that breaks the line because you're now invading on my space. I would love for us at some point to look at banning smoking in bars and also in adult cabarets. Because they're also allowed to be smoking, and if we're not allowing smoking in bars, I don't see any reason to allow smoking in adult establishments.
Just a point on what Robert just brought up. California is a non-smoking state. Period. End of story. And for your information, how they got started, the barmaid sued the state and won a very handsome reward. And that's how basically everything got started in no smoking. So there is a liability factor there. I also would say there is a factor as far as businesses are concerned, competing with those in the cities around us. So I think we'd have to consider that also.
it's a double-edged sword. Personally, I like to go to places that don't smoke. I'll be very open about that without any doubt about anybody's mind. But also, I understand the competitive nature of businesses with the surrounding neighborhoods, that you know, how much business they would lose and how that would affect their bottom line.
Just out of curiosity, anybody know off the top of their head which bars are affected? Actually, even do allow smoking?
Diamond Bar does.
The tavern.
Yeah, tavern, mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think McKendrick's doesn't have a cigar.
Right. Cigar.
Okay. Probably Gillies.
Right.
All right. I'm just curious. All right. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, Tom.
The on section 7, which is page 8 there, that's the graffiti ordinance. Mm-hmm. We copied that
graffiti.
On the graffiti that I passed out.
Graffiti, we copied up.
Lenny. This one was taken from what the other cities have done. The problem with the one that you handed it over was it's a county ordinance, which means that it says that county courts can order people to do something, and unfortunately, we can't pass that because the municipal court doesn't have the same power. So this has the same prohibitions, and it also has that the owner has to take it off within a certain period of time. It has all of the prohibitions that the one you presented had, just some of the, let's say, shalls about what a court shall do. It doesn't have, because I don't think the municipal court has that power.
And I guess the second thing is that when we talk about the owner, a couple of folks in here pointed out that a lot of this occurs on like public utility boxes, like the AT&T or Georgia Power boxes or MARTA, things like that. Is there a mechanism in there to cover that?
I mean, those are owned by the individual utilities or the individual or the MARTA, although you won't be able to force MARTA to do anything. You can try, but you won't be able to force them to do anything. So if there's graffiti on MARTA, you know, bus stops, you know, you can ask citizens to help clean it, but you can't cite it. You can cite MARTA, but the, you know, good luck.
I bet Tom can get more smarter to do a lot of it. Pretty talented guy. All right, Danny.
I think the Gwinnett County is 48 hours, I think, is removal time. Am I correct on that, Lenny?
I don't remember.
I just wondered, is 10 business days, is that a reasonable time? Too long? Too short? I just asked the question. I don't think it's, everything is too short, but I'm sure
it's
too long.
Well, I don't know, reasonability is something you may have to discuss, sure. But, you know, 48 hours, I don't know if it's too short amount of time to require people who may be out of town, let's say, to come back and suddenly they're being cited for something that they didn't even know about.
Right.
So to give them 10 business days, I think, allows for some leniency. If we have problems with it, you can always change it.
Yeah. Chief, you got any words of wisdom on
it? No, I just briefly glanced at it earlier, and I mean, it looks pretty standard type ordinance.
Okay.
One more question. This may be a question for Brian. When the court's task force met, they developed a spreadsheet that was, I don't know, 6 or 7 pages long that had different offenses and the range of fines to go with those offenses. And there's all kinds of extra things that you're allowed to tack on for the cost of processing and the cost of automation and all that stuff. I guess I expected to see that in the back of this ordinance, which is, but it isn't. And I'm wondering, we have to pass that, I think. I just don't know where that is or where the process we go to do that.
Yeah, usually the judge creates the statement of fines, and he has it, and he can present it to the council to bless it. They so desire, but you generally don't put it with the traffic offense.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, but just to further that, too, under the law, the judge has the authority to go from 0 to 1,000 or up to 6 months in jail for any of the offenses listed here. The bond schedule only applies to if you do not contest it and you pay. And as Brian was saying, typically that's the judge's responsibility to set that bond schedule. But certainly, I think any judge appointed by the council would appreciate their input.
Okay.
All right, wonderful. Hey guys, I'm going to need buzzers or something at some point. I'm doing this. That's back, right? You watch the test. That gives me a little bit of exercise, which is me. All right, anything else on 16? All right, move on to 17. Robert?
This one, I thought I'm going a little senile here.
Well, that could be confirmed.
Absolutely, entirely possible. I found some text in here, and then I couldn't find it, and I'm not sure whether it's a versioning issue, but there was a section in an earlier version that talked about the requirements for one-way streets. And then I couldn't find it anymore. And I'm wondering if we took it out.
What that was it was signing requirements, and that sign, what this ordinance does, it adopts a manual of uniform traffic control devices in its entirety, and a lot of the language that was in there for signing one-way streets is duplicated of what's in that manual of uniform traffic control devices.
Okay.
That's why we took it out.
Okay, super. Thank you. But there's nothing in here that prohibits us from creating one-way streets. Okay.
We left the part that says we can create one-way streets.
Okay.
Thank you.
I couldn't find Exhibit A, the speed limit table.
I have copies of it here.
Okay.
And it has...
It's my fault. I can't attach an Excel 2007 file on my computer.
Okay. But I do have this.
Thank you.
Thank you. And one of... I also couldn't find a list of the truck routes.
Right now, we have not established that yet. We're still working on establishing where the existing truck routes are.
Wouldn't the truck routes have been already designated from the county?
It is not in the county ordinance. It is, and that may be information that we're still trying to obtain from DeKalb County, where the ordinance requires that it's on file with the clerk of the public works, but it's not necessarily an attachment to the ordinance. So it's not attached to their current ordinance, and we're still trying to, that's part of the data we're trying to get from DeKalb County right now.
Okay, just the ordinance says that we're going to have that on file, and since I didn't see that part of the package, I wanted to make sure that I asked for it.
Yes.
All right, anything else on 17? All right, 21. Go ahead, Rob.
Two comments.
Yeah.
I note that this ordinance prohibits neon signs, and I think half the businesses in Dunwoody have a neon open sign. And it's not a very big sign, but you'd hate to pass a law making them all illegal by accident. Now, if we don't want them, okay, but... and there was one sign I'd like to see prohibited that I didn't see in there, and it was the Tri-Vision signs.
I'm sorry.
It's defined in the beginning as the signs that have the three sides to them, and there's a long list of prohibited signs, and that's not one of them. And while we have at least two that have gotten grandfathered in by the DeKalb, let's not have any more.
All right, Brian.
Here. Is it covered some?
The changeable copy.
It's called the changeable copy sign.
Well, let me point out that you define a tri-vision sign in the definition section, but you don't prohibit it in the prohibition section, and that might allow someone to take the position that they're not prohibited.
On page 10, it says tri-vision signs.
Okay, I must have missed it. Okay. If you guys tell me it's taken care of, I'm good. Tri-face signs? Okay. Well, then I point out that the definition was for tri-vision, not tri-faced. Well, then I had a different version. Let me look. Again, about this time, your eyes start to glaze over. And does it? Okay. Page 6. Tri-vision sign. There it is. you define a tri-vision sign, but you don't prohibit it. Okay.
All right.
The only other comment I had on signs was it's not clear to me what the requirements are for real estate signs in here. And I dislike them, but I recognize them as being important. And so I don't think we want to prohibit them or inhibit them, but it'd be nice to know sort of what we're allowing so that realtors can stay within the balance.
Brian, is this not correct? Normally, it's real estate. 99% of them are illegal anyway. They're in the right of way. Of course, they can't be. So unless you're looking at a sign for sale and it's your house, any of the directional signs are illegal. Am I correct or incorrect?
Well, if they're in the right of way, you're correct.
Which right of way extends, what, 6 feet into your property? Or somewhere around there, 3 feet?
Varies.
Varies.
According to this, they're saying 5 feet from a cutaway or 10 feet from a right of way.
Okay.
So, which is what?
The definition of standard informational signs is how we apply those for real estate signs. And I spoke with, I can't remember his name, he's the leader of the Board of Realtors for Georgia.
Okay.
And he's in his email. That was one of his concerns as well. Once I explained to him about the standard informational signage applying to real estate signs, he was fine with it.
Okay. Then I'm fine.
Okay, yeah, then. Great, John. Now go ahead.
Doesn't matter.
One of the things that here we are, directly affects all of us. We want to look at establishing some time limits prior to election that political signs can be put up in the city.
Should outlaw.
God, there's a reason.
He's the only one who doesn't have to recuse himself.
I just wonder, what is the standard time? Is there any arguments?
It's in here.
Is it in here?
Yeah, it's in there.
It's in here. What it's in here. 60 days was what I thought, remember?
Get a qualification to election.
Yeah.
Okay. Hold on. Just to clarify, you can leave that up on your property, but you can't just stick political signs in the right of way.
Right.
Correct. Where you see 92% of them
all signs in the
right. So that is still going to be banned. So the 60 days would refer back to private property. Is that right?
Okay.
So it's huge. On page 13, section 8.
Gotcha. All right. So still referring to the private property.
Right.
Well, okay, let's get it down, John.
Well, Carter, changing the subject, please finish with...
Okay, Dan.
I just wonder, I'm being a political soul here. I haven't ran too many times, so I don't. Our data qualification was August 4th, and we ran September 16th, which isn't too bad. But don't some of the qualifications? I think the qualifications for November election was back in July, if I'm not mistaken. I just think that is a. I don't know. We're trying to take a look at the neighborhood and everything else, and. It just seems like an elongated period to me. I mean, I don't know if there's a 30-day or 60-day is more palatable with everyone, but it would be with me rather than, July to November. I mean, that's just, if you can't get your word out there in a couple of months, you probably can't get your word out, I would say, but that's just my opinion. I just like to share everybody else's opinion and see if that's what we do on that.
Dan, does that 60-day include runoff time?
When you start with political speech, you have to be very cautious.
I mean, political speech is very, very protected.
Okay, Robert.
That was the point I was going to make, is I don't think you can limit people's ability to have political speech during a campaign. I suspect that would get thrown out.
Mm. Okay. Are they already limited right here?
we limited it to the campaign.
Right.
Like, we didn't limit it to the 60 days before an election. Because
right.
some people might want to stick their signs out a little earlier for a candidate.
Well, you're not a candidate until you qualify. So as soon as you qualify, I think you get the rights to advertise your candidacy.
One point of clarification. Standard informational signs are limited, okay? This says unlimited for this period of time, so that's the difference. You can do a standard informational sign all year long and say whatever you want to on it. During the time period, typically, you know, qualification is about 60 days before the actual election, so I think it might be closer to what you're talking about.
Okay. John?
I just had 2 points. On Article 2, Section 1, Subsection B is blank. I wonder if there's a reason for it. On page 6. Page 6, Article 2, 1B is blank. I'm just wondering if there's a reason or if it's a... Okay. Another thing I noticed was the, as Ms. Penn mentioned, the banners. There's 14 days banners are allowed. They're allowed 3 times a year. They have to be signed off from what I read. And again, churches, I think, were the biggest culprits in some respects, and I want to make sure that the community, if we pass this, is aware that there's 14 days, 3 times each. That's the only thing I just want to make sure that's well aware of it. And how does that differ from DeKalb, if I could ask? Okay.
Consistent enforcement issue.
Non-conforming signs. I'd like to see a section, I think, in Marietta had passed one that gives time frames for non-conforming signs.
Well, we looked that up. There is significant case law that states that non-conforming signs, it, in most cases, represents a taking, even though you do give them a standardized time to recoup their economic value, which is most federal courts recognize that. Georgia courts have pretty much unanimously said it's a taking.
Okay. I would like to see non-conforming.
We will readdress the issue.
All right. Thank you. Anything else on...
I have one question.
Could you raise your hand and recognize before you speak, please?
Yes, sir. On point of order, with our work session, we can call in the audience, but it's not a give and take with the audience. So,
sure, absolutely. We've been a little loosey-goosey on this, but
with that, I'll call up an expert. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I just have a question concerning standard informational signs regarding real estate. And I wanted to get a better feel for the measurement. Many of you who live in the area know that a standard real estate sign is usually you see about this wide and stands that tall. But occasionally you see one on a 6-foot pole hanging. And I just wanted clarification if that means we're going to stick with the 4-foot sign in the Dunwoody area, or if it's permitted, or how it would be permitted to put the 6-foot pole sign or vinyl sign that, you know, flexibly. And I'm not sure I see that, understand where that is here, and I
thank you, I apologize for anything. No problem. Okay, anything on 21? Anything else on 21? John, first.
Can we get an advisement from council or from staff on how that reads?
Sure, on real estate.
On the real estate?
Sure, I think it's, go ahead.
We can obviously change that if you'd like to, essentially, it says that you have a maximum of 4. That's the old approach.
I'm reading page 11.
I think we're looking at section 5, 1. page 11. Is that what it says? 24 square foot per lot, right? Okay, and that 24 square foot can be any which way you want. Okay. Where's that 4 foot? Is that? Oh, I see it. Number 4. Okay.
Mr. Mayor,
yes,
could we ask them to go ahead and put in here that real estate signs are to be treated as informational signs, just to take the ambiguity out?
Well, I think some of the attorneys may need to speak on this, but they try to stay away from content, be content neutral, and therefore if we specify a real estate sign, we have to...
Okay, that's a good point.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and I think, too, there's a distinction, too, between what you can put in your code and what you put on your website. I think a lot of cities are going toward FAQs on the website to deal with a lot of these common issues that y'all are bringing up on when do you need a permit and you know, real estate signs okay. We can answer that question in layman's terms and avoid the change in the ordinance. I think we can cover that because I think we're going to get those questions.
Okay, so if I'm reading 4 feet above the grade level, that's not your standard real estate sign. That's still a post sign. Mm-hmm. Does that sound correct? I mean, 4 feet is your regular real estate sign of, what, 12 inches off the ground? Kevin, what do you say?
Sorry.
Those are post. Okay. All right. Any other comments? All right, moving on. Chapter 23.
I actually have no comments on this. If you have no comments, I'll go.
It talks about bus shelters. Bus shelters in the right of way. I noticed that there are a number of lit bus shelters on our streets. And it also talks about franchise fees for ad revenue. Are we aware of how long those franchise fees are? Have they already been paid to the cab? Are they ongoing? Will the city of Dunwoody get any of those franchise fees for the lit advertising on our city's right-of-way? Have we looked into any of that?
Right. We have not looked into it, but one would assume now that we're a city, we should definitely be able to collect the advertising franchise fee.
Can you repeat that?
Well, I'm just saying, generally they will contact you to discuss those issues because you are now the franchising authority, so you would, that's usually a conversation that will take place.
Great.
Okay. Yes, Dan.
Would this include, this is John's idea, MARTA signs? You know, it says, keep advertising MARTA.
Yeah, that's a great thing. MARTA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
You said MARTA will contact us.
Well,
it's a government agency. MARTA shelter.
It is not a local.
It doesn't request us.
No.
So it does not include MARTA signs.
But I want to make sure I understand the distinction. The distinction, as I understand it, is that a sign that is on a MARTA bus stop that advertises a commercial product, yes, it would cover that. If it's a sign that says, MARTA bus over there, then no.
Okay.
And I think you're referring to the commercial aspect.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was looking at the bus shelters that have lit advertising for movies and for a number of other... Okay, just so we're clear. That's in our right-of-way, and I want to make sure that that's addressed.
Okay, anything else on 23? 27?
Robert? I've got... My concerns really just fall into two categories. The easy one is that I thought that the allowance... The requirement for the number of parking spaces for a lot of the commercial type businesses was way too high, and that it would lead people to building bigger parking lots than we might want. A food store requires one space for every 100 square feet. For a restaurant, it requires a space for every 75 square feet. For general retail, it's a space for every 250 square feet, and the same for shopping center. And a lot of the parking lots in Dunwoody spend most of their time largely empty. And it strikes me that I'd rather work a little harder to find a parking space and have a little less asphalt then be sure that they're putting in plenty of parking. So that one worries me. The other was the need to see a map to go along with the prohibitions on sexually oriented businesses. It's hard for me, from this description, to understand where sexually oriented businesses could and could not, and how many of them we could have. It feels like we need to have, you know, I read through it, but I can't picture it. And that seems important to me.
I know what you're thinking.
All right. So maybe perhaps a bad choice of words.
Okay.
So is there an option for us to get a map to go along with the ordinance?
We're working on that
as
we speak. Hopefully by...
Okay. And that,
we're working on it.
That would not actually be part of this.
No, it's in the sexually oriented business. When we're actually going to show you the map.
Yeah, okay. But the map itself would not be...
Trying to get a map to show you.
All right, John, could you make a point of that? I'm sure you're involved on the mapping side of it that everybody gets.
Now, I wrote those comments in my section 27. Did I mess that up? Had I gone on to something else? Or was there sections in 27? Was there pieces in 27 that
your objective in section 7 reference it. Section 4.2, which is around 200s of pages. That's where the zoning portion of the sexually oriented business ordinance sits. And yes, we are working on the maps right now just to figure out how many feet distance we're going to assign it. But it's going to be the 4,000, or whether it's going to be less, depending on how many locations.
Yeah, right. That's what we need before we vote on that.
Yeah. We don't have that map yet. They're working on it.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Danny?
I looked in here for something that had reference to parking on the street in front of a residential home. Restrictions on that, and I couldn't find it because it doesn't mean it's not going to do something. And, you know, my point is that case in point, it flew around on the thing today a lot about this individual who broke into some homes. You know, they're parking their cars all up on the yard. I thought that there was something in the county thing that said you could only park your car on the street in front of your house under certain conditions for a certain amount of time. And I could not find that in here anywhere. And also the number of cars that you could park at like an R100 residential place. You know, how many cars can you actually have there? Any input from anybody that where's that at or anything? Or is it here?
Some of the parking may be in Chapter 23. I don't know the exact place on it, but some of the restrictions on parking, the actual parking itself is in 23, but that doesn't cover the zoning portion.
I will comment that I remember seeing that you cannot park your car on someone else's property without their consent. So there was a requirement that if you pull up on somebody else's yard, that's a violation of code.
Yeah, you can't park on it.
But I think the street is the street. I mean, I think we all pay for the streets, and I think you can park on any place on the street that's not blocking traffic. If I want to park in front of your house, as long as I'm in the street and not in your property, I think I'm okay.
I thought there was something in the county ordinance that said you cannot park your private vehicles out in the street over a certain period of time.
Is Ms. Penn still here?
I'm here. There's no limit on the number of cars parked on a street, because that's a frequent problem with rental properties when they have up to 6 unrelated people living in a house and not all the cars could fit in the driveway. There is something, John, you remember that, you had looked it up. There is something, you are correct in the DeKalb codes, where you cannot keep a car unmoved for a certain amount of days. So if the car is unmoved and just parked on the street, there is something in the DeKalb County codes. I don't remember, was 3 days?
I'll look it up in the Muni code when I get home.
We've had cars removed that were parked for months, unmoved on the street.
Kind of abandoned.
But I know that it's a much shorter period of time. But you are right, there is something in the DeKalb codes about that. But not on the number of bars.
Public Works got most of the time.
Yes.
In Chapter 17, Article, which is now Article 6, Abandoned Vehicles, covers some of that as far as the...
Page is that?
Unlawful for a person to park or abandon a commercial boat, vehicle, recreational vehicle, or trailer upon the streets or upon right away the streets, and allow, say, commercial boat or motor vehicle to remain parked or abandoned for more than 72 consecutive hours. Now, that doesn't cover passenger vehicles, but that's where, I mean, it could be amended in that if the council so desired. But it covers, there is a part in Article, in Chapter 17 that addresses that.
I'd like to see that included.
I would like to see us add something like that somewhere, about parking in the street, R100, R150, whatever, areas over a long period of time. I think it's, what's good for all of the cabs may not be good for all of Dunley. So I think that's something I think we need to take a look at. Most people are kind to their neighbors, others aren't. And I've seen a couple houses where they just park their cars, the driveway's full, and they park the rest of them on the street at the time. I don't think the citizens should have to put up with that.
Okay, John? I'm interested to hear more of the proposal, but I also want to be reasonable. In the lifespan of a family, myself included, I have three young children. I have three boys. When they hit high school age, I'm not sure where my children are going to park their cars if the driveway... We need to be reasonable. I mean, for large families, cars are going to need to be jockeyed around and parked on the street sometimes. So I just want to make sure that that's well thought out.
Tom? Including not just cars, but trucks, but any vehicles. I see a lot of, trailers... and things like that, for commercial painters or things like that, that they'll not have the car or the truck or the trailers and have those.
Okay. As I understand what the Cab County has done, it would have to be there for 72 hours. I mean, in your case, John, I think that would probably be covered because your kid's going to be going to volleyball for about football practice or whatever.
Well, what's the age? By the time your kids get licenses, isn't the age 19 to drive now? You don't have to worry about it, John. Plus, we'll all stop driving cars. We'll be riding bikes.
There you go. Walkable, bikeable.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this?
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
Did you want to bring up the number of unrelated people that can actually be in one single-family residence?
Yes,
currently it's 6 in DeKalb County. That's what we've mirrored in ours.
Yes, I would like to see that changed. Do we have some municipalities we can lean on what's a reasonable 6? It seems an apartment building.
The law states reasonable. If you have a reasonable reason to regulate it, you can go down. Athens, where it has a large community of actual, renters and large people, they were having significant problems with that, overcrowding the streets, driveways, no place to park. And there, the courts did allow a number as low as three people, three unrelated. And that's the lowest I've seen. I don't know if that'd be reasonable in our town.
What's the definition of related?
It says related by blood. They actually don't define it in the ordinance I've seen.
Do you know what the actual definition of related? We have to look at it. It talks about the actual familial relationships in there. And that can become an issue that
verifies it, though.
Attorneys will often contest it.
Okay. Yes, John.
Is there any option for a separate zoning code for these types of businesses or these types of residents and have them licensed as such? The reason I'm thinking of this is right behind my house on North Peachtree Road is the Atlanta Center for Eating Disorders, which is based on Barclay. But they have a house that they have purchased. They have off-site parking, but they have put $200,000, $300,000 into this single-family residence to make it livable for 6 different people as a treatment center
basically a place for them to live. And by taking this, changing this definition, it would put them in a non-complying use. I'm just wondering, for that specific example, is there any other thing that we could do besides change the number of people?
So you could have a different zoning.
That's kind of my question. Special use permit? That way they'd be licensed, we would know where they are, and then we could take a look at the parking examples, parking situation, we could look at the different aspects of the...
Yeah, Robert?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to add to that, we're looking at sending to you shortly, it's called the International Property Maintenance Ordinance. You've got to adopt it separately from all these other ordinances. And in that ordinance, it specifies square footage for rooms and people, as opposed, in addition to the family that we talked about earlier. So that's a more enforceable way to go in and be able to get this entire property.
John, out of curiosity, in that particular house, is that an issue with the residents?
No. In fact, we met with that establishment. We talked to them. There's a caretaker who lives in that house and deals with the residents who are being treated down the street. It's really just a place for them to live. They have off-site parking, half block down on Barclay. They're good neighbors. We're happy to have them. But again, their house is specifically made to have six different people, unrelated, living under the roof. The house was modified as such.
It seemed to me that would be almost a slough or something. If a neighbor said that's good, but you could see a lot of neighbors saying, are you crazy? You know, I don't want to sit. That's not okay for me. So it seems like we should be able to deal with that on a, we're okay with it or we're not okay with it. But yeah, Robert?
My libertarian tendencies are coming out again. If you got six kids who want to share rent on an apartment near the college, if they're good, if they behave and they're not disruptive, I'm not sure that it's my business. I'm reluctant, I guess.
There was a house on Field until they got evicted that had a three-bedroom, one-bath house that has 16 people living in it, unrelated. Okay, there's always 11 or 12 cars or vans out in the yard. If I'm not mistaken, the tenant's neighbor who got arrested for burglary the other day was a serial burglar. They had five or six unrelated people living in that house, and been a source of complaints like that. I just think you end up getting situations where you have to limit it in some way just for property values. When you have 16 people living in a single three-bedroom house.
Yeah, but we've got square footage requirements. What number of bedrooms you're going to have so many people. If the kitchen has to be so big for so many people, that's in the code as we exist now.
Well, and it's already limited to six. Mm-hmm. So 16 would certainly be.
I'd like to see that number lower.
I'd throw myself in the ring. I'd like to see that number lower. I think, John, in your case, this might be a legitimate almost business, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, that's different than, I think, a residential home. I don't know if you can differentiate there. I'm not too sure.
But they fall under the R100 code, allows up to six different individuals living under the roof, and that's the way the house is zoned and coded, and they were in compliance. But again, they did a lot of work, spent a lot of money to get the house up to par to have those number of people living separately in the house.
If that's the issue on the specific house, it would be grandfathered, and they wouldn't be in non-compliance. Now, I guess a change in circumstance may put them in non-compliance, but if they continue in that particular use, they would be grandfathered in. If you went to a lower standard.
Okay.
Yes, David.
I would like to see the number lowered to 4. That's my personal opinion. Yeah. The residential home.
Any thoughts on that?
I was thinking more 3, but that looked pretty good.
Okay. Yes, Robert?
Can we do 5?
And under what time frames, if I could ask, I mean, during the holiday season, I might have two groups of family living with me. I might have...
They're related.
Some of them are.
John, you can use the ordinance as acoustic kick them out.
The in-laws are not related by blood.
I know that Bill Gross would like to say something.
Okay.
If you want to call him, Bill, Bill would like to.
Yeah.
I just remember that in the supplemental regulations, the zoning ordinance, it allows an exception with a permit from the Board of Appeals and the City Council.
Okay, mm-hmm. So current.
That's in what you're doing now. It's the end of the zoning ordinance, but I don't remember the particular number.
We're further discussion. I think we're at 4 for the sunhouse. Okay. Any other thoughts on that? All right. Discussion on community council. Yes, Denny?
Where did you leave this parking aspect for that?
We're going to look it up.
Community Council, I'll start on this one. I'd ask for feedback from the known entities, and many of them are in this room that have had experience in DeKalb County on how things work with the Planning Commission and Board of Appeals and Community Council. And after reviewing all of the feedback, I'll go ahead and fire this first shot. I've come to the conclusion that I do support the community council. I think we should have 7 just nominated members as the process we're going through now with planning and Board of Appeals. But I do think it seems like 1 would be more than enough to cover our radius. So I'll throw that out as the first thought. To you guys. Robert?
I love it.
John?
DeKalb County currently has a community council for each district, which if we were to do that, we would have at least 3. I can live with 1.
Okay.
I can live with 1.
All right, Brian, you could note that. Any other thoughts on that?
I think it's a good idea.
All right.
Personally, I think it's a good idea. And I think the other thing, it might save us some time in the the zoning process, because the public will already have their chance to ferret out their wishes and ideas this morning, and then we can get into it. Otherwise, yeah. People would kick us kickbacks, and we have the redos all the time, the 60-day redos.
Okay, moving on to the easy one, sexually oriented business licensing. And Robert, I believe you mentioned a video or something.
I thought that was what Lenny gave us last week. Those were
documents. Oh, I didn't look at it.
I put it on DVD part and I couldn't get it to work. Yeah, that's awesome.
Just to echo the 2 comments I made earlier, 1 is the map is really an important part of this for us to understand what we're passing. And 2, there's a phrase in here that allows for smoking. And I would just be as happy to eliminate smoking in adult-oriented businesses as I would in bars. And if you eliminate them in both, I don't think you can take the position that you're picking on the sexually oriented businesses. So that's a reason to get rid of them in bars.
Okay. It seems like an odd place to allow smoking.
I only read them, I don't write them.
Okay, any other comments on this? They're working on a map that will get out for review. Any other thoughts? Brian, you have something, Lenny?
No? I missed your comments, sorry.
On sexually oriented businesses. Anything?
Only that the version you have should be the pretty much latest version we have so far. The 1 thing that we don't have, once again, are the distances that were set at 1,000 feet, but right. We're trying to make sure that that won't zone them out.
All right.
In which case, we would be in bad form. So okay. That's the only thing we've left to go. Otherwise, you pretty much have the final version of what it's going to look like on Thursday.
All right, thank you. All right, 2009 budget, Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. What you have before you in your packet is a budget summary, which is the latest version of the budget. The level of detail that we have for this presentation is just going to be a presentation of the expected revenue in the different categories and then the expenses by department. We are still working. Obviously, it's been a significant moving target before we put the three contracts into place. So we're still working at this time to get you the level of detail that would explain every number and exactly what the requests are for each of the department areas. But I think this is embedded considerably as a fairly reasonable representation of where we are. It certainly can be adjusted to meet any policy needs that you have. One of the concerns that we have is just from being going through this process for the first time in this city, is that the revenues, while we think we've budgeted for them accurately and most importantly conservatively, it's just going to need to be monitored extra carefully on a more than regular basis to make sure that we're hitting these targets, because as we can't control a number of the revenue items, we can control some of the expense items. So there may be multiple budget amendments that are brought to you in the first year to make sure that we are surplus at the end of the year and not deficit. I've done this for 11 years and never had a deficit, and I don't really feel like starting now. So we're going to surplus at the end of this year.
Okay. Yeah, Dan. This year we've got an extraordinary item, the franchise fees from Georgia Power, $2.5 million, roughly dollars. Next year, of course, that won't be there, but I know we've got another fee that's coming in for about $1.5 million. So we've got $1 million in shortfall going into next year versus the revenue that we know is coming in this year. Are you comfortable with going out of the year with $500,000 surplus when we know full well that we're going to have a $1 million shortfall on revenue?
I am. I'll explain why. When you look at the budget, we've got a number of items that are one-time, extraordinary items that a city government normally would not spend money on. In the contract that we have with Boykin and some of the other startup costs in the police department, you've got some considerable startup costs that are not going to be ongoing costs. I think those will exceed the difference between the Georgia Power franchise and the other revenue source. Additionally, it's difficult at this point to tell exactly how these revenue sources are going to come in. So if we come in, for example, on finding forfeitures is estimated conservatively at $430,000, that could easily be an $800,000 item, or we could miss on something toward the top. So it's just difficult to tell at this point exactly how the revenues are going to come in. But I feel confident that there's enough on the expense side. There are one-year, first-year costs that we can get rid of for a year or two.
Yeah. Follow up, Dan?
Yeah.
On police, on this budget, how many cars did you bake into this budget?
What was the final?
It's 18.
18 or... Okay. I think 18 cars is what we're looking at right now. We're still looking at all of the leasing options that we had talked about. Extending those out. I think we've basically gotten one of the options, which is look at 5-year lease purchase on some of the vehicles. What we're planning on doing on the vehicles right now is phasing it in over 2 years. From a competitive standpoint, in recruiting police officers, take-home vehicles are going to be a very important component, but to buy 37 vehicles in 1 year is clearly not a financial possibility. So what we're planning on doing is running the fleet concept for the first 2 years, for the first year, whereas the cars are running more on a 24/7 basis with officers switching into them. And then in year two, we're planning on purchasing a similar number of vehicles, also spreading those costs out over a 5-year basis. But at that point, we'd have enough vehicles to put one car per officer.
And what the life of that vehicle would be that you have the 24/7 going on?
For the first year, it's going to be, it's going to reduce the life of the expected vehicle. If you do a one man, one woman per car, then you expect about a 5-year life on the car. On the fleet, you're talking more like a 2 to 3 year life cycle. So in the first year, I think we're going to be abusing those vehicles more than we normally would, but also we're only running on a 9-month basis instead of 12 months. So I think we got a little mileage to play with.
How much residual value does a police car have after 5 years?
Zero, pretty much. I mean, it can be used for, in some cases, to put into investigative services. In some cases, it can be used for other city staff. But mostly, cities are surplusing those vehicles and auctioning them off for sale and getting $1,500 or $2,000 on a great day.
Would we be better off if we let somebody else worry about the residual value? It could bring down our cost if we did that. It could be even more in the form of a true lease. What you have now is really a lease purchase,
right,
as opposed to it's not really a true lease. It's sort of just a purchase. It's a financing.
That is the second option we're looking at and researching to see if we can do that. Right. It may end up being more cost efficient if we can find a program.
I'd like to see the financial analysis that would show buying all the police cars and we get a quality police force in place and have cars that we could use for the full 5 years as opposed to have some of them have to be junked after maybe 3 or 4 years because they were used 24/7 on the front end. And I think we can do this, as I indicated in the email to you, that we can do it by structuring a lease. It's a step lease that will allow you to reduce, you know, defer the cost, if you will, from year one when you don't have the money to pay for it. But if we put the residual value in there, obviously $1,500, if somebody else takes a risk on that, it could bring down the cost. So I think if we are very creative in our financing here, we can come up with the best of both worlds, where we can have the use of the cars, but we can have the financing structure that would mean we can afford it.
Right, and that is one of the options we're looking at.
I'd like to have you know.
Okay, Robert?
Yeah, a couple of points. One, I do note that in addition to a $572,000 surplus, you're also indicating a $500,000 transfer to a contingency fund. So we've basically estimated expenses at $1 million lower than revenue, right? So there's a little more room, obviously there's also the startup expenses that we'll incur the first year. And that number looks high from what I've been hearing in terms of our actual startup expenses, but maybe there's more in there that I don't hear. The only other question I had was, how much did you allot for DeKalb County for police for the interim period before we get our own?
We estimated 430 a month, so 1.2 and 90,
so
about 1.3 million.
So $430,000 a month? And do we have agreement at that?
That was the last thing on the table.
Okay.
That was their last offer. Okay. So I figured it hopefully won't go higher than that.
Okay, okay, good. All right, so I feel better about that. Okay. And I'd love to see some more detail, but we'll work through that. Right.
It's coming.
What kind of overlap did you plug in there? I know we talked to the chief last time about when he's going to start building the force up. During the time we're spending the 430, we're also going to be having some of our force on board.
We have a building. We'll be able to show you the cash flow model, which is still kind of a little bit of a moving target. But what we're showing there is that we'll start incurring some costs on Wednesday when the chief comes on full time. Obviously, very little.
Should have asked for a raise.
Compared to the overall size of the police budget. So we will be starting to show a gradual increase because we'll be putting our command staff in January and then we'll be purchasing equipment as we go. It's really going to hit in March when we're really showing a double cost where we're almost running a full department in March at the same time we're paying DeKalb for the IGA because we need that probably 20 to 30 day period where we're going to have all of our staff employed on the payroll doing the necessary training to be able to stand up April 1st and start taking 911 calls. So March is going to be a very high cash month for us.
And again, reminder, Robert, you're on the finance side, and
router plug in with your warning and help, obviously, in any way. And then just you talk amongst you guys, whoever's interested, throw your hat to Robert. And I know there's at least one. So, yes, Nelson, I think.
A couple things, Warren, on the police force. So 1 April is our target date, correct?
Yes, sir.
And we're going to hit that target date, correct?
Yes, sir.
Number two, on your expenditures, right now we've got, myself and maybe one other one coming in here, city employees, and to the end of the year, starting January 1, with the, a lot of city employees, and we've got some meetings with HR on this, and then when the police come on, the benefit package. Are you able to address that all tonight, or is that still something that you have, or is, I'm talking about, insurance package, whatever, one fine benefit, fine contribution,
etc. Let me talk to you about, we haven't made a decision to make, or we haven't formulated the final recommendation at this point. Let me tell you from a process standpoint where we are, because we have been working on this since I started employment about a month ago, is that we have working with a broker on the private side to see what options they are able to present to us, and we've gotten a recommendation from them. We met with the Georgia Municipal Association staff today and got their presentation and package, so that we're at the point right now we're taking both of those possibilities, which is pretty much going to be the most of the universe of all the options that we can look at, and then comparing the costs to the city, and then trying to match that up with, from a competitive standpoint, from a recruitment, and also looking at what we can overall afford to be able to offer in a package. And then we're going to come back to council with a full recommendation. So we're looking at all the options at this point, so I'm not really ready to kind of get into the recommendations.
Okay. John?
A couple items. Looking at the different items on the expense and revenue. For information, can you tell me what the expense for non-departmental, $1.2 million, $2.5
million? I'll try and do this on the top of my head. Some of that cost is going to be your legal services. Let me get back with you on that.
Okay. As a side note, laptops might be nice for all of us instead of paper, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Jump drive would work wonders past that. A couple other things. Fines and forfeitures, $430,000. I believe the CVI was much lower.
Much higher?
Much higher. It's almost double. Okay.
What we're looking at there is the... obviously we don't have a quota system. We're not trying to come up with a number we got to hit on a target basis. The chief is not going to get that kind of direction from me. What we're estimating there is a much lower number than was projected both by the task force and the CBI study. And the reason why, one, I think it's important to be conservative in nature. With those kind of figures, it would be better to come out higher than lower. The second thing is that with the size of the police force that we're projecting, with the square mileage that we have, I don't think we're going to have the resources up front to be having 3 and 4 officers on a traffic task force unit or doing some of the other recommendations that have come forward. We're going to be running calls for the most part and then running traffic when we can. So I just want to be conservative. The other estimate, the reason for the estimate I think that was higher initially was that we would be running traffic on 285. And I don't think that's going to be a priority for us in the front end, because we certainly don't have the resources to be able to cover the manpower that that's going to require on the highway. So we tried to back it down as far as we could. And again, it's also a 9-month number,
right?
Because we're not anticipating, although it was discussed with the DeKalb County, and we are going to give them our traffic citations January 1 in hopes that they'll use them. But we're not anticipating that, we're not expecting that they will.
One last item. The sale of printed material for the police, I mean, it's a minor item, $14,000, but what does the police sell for $14,000?
Police reports.
Police reports?
To insurance companies.
Yeah. Okay. That's,
Then, just a couple things, you know, in the budget for everybody.
Is that much? Yeah.
Everybody's kind of been involved and hacked on this. And John, number one, I think the fines and forfeitures for the CBI study was a 12-month period.
Okay.
And we reduced that to a 9-month. So that, and then everything, we were trying to be conservative, but when Warren came in, our first budget meeting that we had, and I think the mayor was there, and Robert was there, we hacked around, and the main idea we came across was, and it was basically Warren's idea, and I guess maybe some others had input, but is to be extremely conservative on the low side of the revenue and high on the expenses,
right.
Because that's factor that the end of the year is a 6-month period, and I think Warren already will tell you that somewhere around the end of June, he wants to get, you know, everybody, all the vendors and everything else, and take a good look at where we are, how goes it for the first 6 months of the year to see where we are.
And obviously, on top of that, we'll be doing a monthly financial report, you know, once we actually have money, starting in January, that will show you all a number of measures that we're going to put in that report to be able to show our fiscal health and indicators. But I'll be probably looking at it on a weekly basis in the beginning to make sure that we're not seeing any emerging trends that we need to be cautious of. Because as I said before, in any governmental budget, or probably business in some cases, well, not business, in governmental budgets, you have a limited amount of control over your revenues. So it's really the expense side that we need to be taking a very careful look at the first year, because we're just not sure where the revenues are going to come in. So a little bit nervous, but I think that's probably a good way to manage is nervous.
Right, any other questions for Warren? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Brian? I'm looking at an old
thing. What do I
have? B proposal?
Yeah, B proposal.
It should be in the back. You have the Cab County fee proposal. It should be the back fee structure that the Cab County currently has.
Okay. So that's your big presentation? Next time, you just don't put presentation, just put fee proposal. I'd expect a big bang, you know? Okay, yes,
thank you. I'm not an expert on tax rates and fee proposals, and I read all this, and the one thing there, the top there, I think I sent you an email I think we need to scratch out county and put the city there under one commercial businesses there.
Yes.
And wherever it says county, put city. And then, the classes above, they relate down to here. It says class here. It says the category up here. The category one relates to class one down here.
Okay, what? It's saying the item number, like commercial businesses, miscellaneous is six. Does that correspond with that second grid?
Yes.
Tax class?
Yes.
Okay.
So basically that should be that's category percent. Okay. You have an administration fee, a straight $75. I remember that being thrown around earlier when we were talking about this. And then it's a $4 fee per employee, and that's part-time or full-time? Is that correct? I'm just reading into this because basically I...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the gross receipts, there is a memo out from the city manager. It's actually from the finance administration project manager about amending the gross receipts document going from federal income tax return to the Georgia state income tax return.
Yeah, we plan on doing that.
And we discussed that the other day over there. I just want to maybe Mike and the rest, or maybe if Georgia's still here, the income control.
What is going
on over there?
Two lines are here, too.
Somebody can explain that to everyone. Why we would do that?
Sure. Mayor and City Council, the reason for not using the federal tax language in the ordinance is because there are a lot of firms that actually have offices throughout the U.S. So we really want to segregate that and only ask for the state so that it's going to relate to the state earns cash receipts here. A good example, of course, would be Boykin International. They have offices throughout the U.S. or other states. And by asking for the Georgia, we have the information that we need.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Is there, in fact, the smaller the business, the higher the rate is. If you look at home businesses, the rate per dollar gross revenues is 0.0005, where if you're in a commercial business, it's 0.0018. I mean, is there any logic to charging a higher rate for a small home business? We don't want to put these guys out of business.
Well, one thing you do have is you have a $20,000. First 20,000 has a flat rate of $50. So all businesses do have the first $20,000 same rate. Okay. Although there is some truth to what you're saying, but what this is the caps. And we're not saying the cap put a lot of time, effort, or thought into it. But all we can say is this is the caps. And I agree with you. There is some home businesses that are charged a higher rate.
But they don't get charged that until they reach the 20,000.
Until they reach the 20,000, that's correct.
Yeah.
And just to, somewhere about two or three meetings ago, came up with anyone that had either revenues or receipts of 12,000 or less would not be required a business license. Was it revenues or receipts?
That was someone who's
income. I'm sorry.
But one that was someone whose secondary job didn't need a business license or pay the occupational tax. If it was under 12, was it 12,000 at the end? I don't remember what we finally ended up with.
I believe that's right.
It was gross.
It was 12,000.
Gross revenues, not income.
It was gross revenues.
I just wonder if that number isn't a little high. Is that an arm?
No. This is something that the committee just kind of decided to try and make it to someone who's got a home business. Doing this on the side, we didn't want to have a large percentage of our population out of compliance. These are people who typically, you know, are just doing it on the side. They're not professional. We don't want it to make them have professional help and, you know, incur a lot of expenses. So we were just trying to figure out what would be a number that these people would have to make before it starts becoming a legitimate business. Robert could probably address more of the reasoning.
I don't remember where the number came from, because there were six or eight of us in the room, and we bandied back and forth. But it was really designed around the Tupperware lady, right? It's the idea that somebody might have a home business that's incidental, and to make them come and get a business license and pay a fee for something that's not a primary source of income for the family seemed like, you know, we're basically trying to we don't want to hassle people, right? We want to make this something that makes sense for people. So that was the $1,000 a month. We figured there's very few people who are independent contractors and making less than $1,000 a month and calling that a real business. The discussion centered mostly around hairstylists, many of whom are self-employed, right? So when you go to a salon, many of these people have their own business license tacked up next to their chair, and they're renting that chair. And we wanted to set a break so that we were conscious of whether those people are getting taxed or not, and we figured that they'd be, if they were making over $1,000 a month, it made sense for them to have a business license.
Is there any precedence from any other cities Warren, maybe you can comment from your past experience, or anybody, is there any kind of precedence in other cities? I mean, are we setting precedents, or is that already been set?
I apologize. Can you ask me from the beginning of the comment?
So, exempting anyone with less than $12,000 gross revenues from requiring a business license.
Secondary income. I've
saying it can't happen. So, I mean, certainly the fundamental logic that was displayed made some sense, so it's certainly defensible. But it's not common.
I don't have any problem with doing it. I just wondered, $12,000, you're starting to exempt a lot of businesses.
But you're only exempting people who don't do this as their primary line of work. If this is their primary line of work, they have to get a business license no matter how much they make. This is only for people who can demonstrate that this isn't their primary source of income. So it's in the ordinance is incidental or secondary, I think. Do you remember?
I think it's incidental that and defined it as non-primary.
Yeah, okay.
I think the criteria for this not being a primary source of income would be very interesting to look at.
Yeah.
Okay.
My question was that what do you do with people with income both in Dunwoody and out of Dunwoody, but who have income all within the state? So, for example, Coca-Cola, right? If we get their state income tax returns, how do we assess them? Because they will obviously have income everywhere. It's the same problem that you talked about on the federal level, but just on just at a smaller level. How do we do that?
Normally, we ask them to provide us with a report out of their accounting system that would segregate for a specific area. Okay. And that would come as additional information that we would require.
Okay.
Anything else?
Before we move on, I have an announcement. I was going to thank Richard Meehan. I believe he's already gone. He's our Public Works Director. I'm happy to announce that on Monday, the City of Dunwoody, together with Kingsley Elementary, submitted a almost $500,000 grant application to improve sidewalks, crosswalks up and down North Peachtree Road. Kingsley, Tom did a great job over there, the principal. And I just want to thank Richard Meehan, who I guess is not here, but the City of Dunwoody on day 13 submitted a $500,000 grant application for state improvements to our roads.
When did that come out?
In March.
Very nice. Okay. Does anybody have anything else yet? Oh, yes. Please, go ahead, Danny, do the honors.
Ken and I were asked last week to go to Dunwoody High School to judge a branding class session. The Fortenberry class over there had worked this semester on putting together a branding for the new city of Dunwoody. And they divided up into five teams, and they invited Ken and I to come over and hear the presentations, which they all made, and judge the presentation on who had the best branding. It's not anything binding on us or anything to do with branding, but it's very interesting. First of all, I think Ken and I were very impressed with the caliber of our people there at Dunwoody High School. That class was, they were just full of enthusiasm and ideas that they had and creativity that they brought to the table. But they produced a presentation, they produced brochures, they produced a branding statement, they produced a logo, and three of the five came forward with a tree, kind of as the logo, being a strong foundation that Dunwoody had when it started to grow. It's kind of the underlying theme of that. One of them came forward with a theme that we felt was unique, and that was a branding that included the old and the new of Dunwoody. It included a picture of the farmhouse with skyscrapers behind it, and the branding statement that they had, small town feel with big city appeal. That was a statement that they had for Dunwoody, which we thought was unique, and they put together a lot of activities that happened in Dunwoody, and we were just pleased that we were invited to start with, but also pleased with the caliber of thought that went into the presentation that we judged. I just want to comment that maybe at some future time we'll have time to present a video that one of this group actually put together for the interview of the people of Dunwoody on Dunwoody and the things they liked about it, etc.
Very nice.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
Do you want to address the meeting on the 22nd? Sure, I'd like you to address on the
meeting. What's going to
happen? No, we are not going to have a meeting on the 22nd. The 18th meeting is going to be a marathon.
Yeah.
If it needs to be, it'll be whatever it has to be. The doors will stay open. And the 22nd, we will not have a meeting. And the 29th is still a go.
It's a budget
quorum. We right now have a quorum. From what I understand, please email me if you will not be here on the 29th.
Everybody's back here next week.
Thursday. Okay. Is there any reason we don't have public comment on?
That's just a minute.
Just for that.
For work sessions, usually we just get it to begin.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And one other thing I'll add before we adjourn. It's really, I guess, worn for your team, but it seems like everybody's going after this free federal money now. Randy from above.
You got emails too, huh?
Not only Mayor Franklin, but now I see John McDonough and our friends in Sandy Springs. So go after every freaking city you can.
Report that.
Yeah, they talk about things, quick hits that can be completed in 90 days. Everybody's submitting. I don't know what the deadlines are, but it looks like coming up in January. But please keep that on your radar. Yes, John?
One of the upcoming presentations that I know we're going to have, part of my Safe Route to Schools application, grant application that we just did, we did assessments of all the schools and the needs, the capital improvements around all the schools. Paige Olson will be giving us a list in the very near future of capital improvements around schools. So if you're looking for a list to put together for a grant application, that might be a good place to start.
Absolutely. Just more stuff, more. I think you're going to report day 18 or whatever.
Right. Second.
Thank you, guys.